You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jeff Sharlet's bestseller, The Family, was an investigation into the influence of Christian fundamentalism at the highest levels of American power. In his latest book, Sweet Heaven, When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between, he continues his look at faith and religion through 13 essays about the ways people navigate the path between belief and doubt. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jeff Sharlet back to our show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard.
When you set out to investigate faith, what do you mean exactly? Are you talking about true believers?
Oftentimes true believers and also true doubters. You know, I use the subtitle Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. And that country in between is where I think most of us live, this kind of oscillation between conviction and uncertainty. But really, faith and religion defined as broadly as a Hudson, you know, this is a big category in our lives.
Well, in fact, I would imagine that's a hard thing to even write about religion, because we're talking about something that's incredibly varied. But this country is described as one of the most religious in the world, isn't it?
It is, and in a lot of interesting ways. Probably people out there listening have ideas about whether that's for the better or the worse. But one of the things that's most interesting about that, the sort of common denominator, and there's very few common denominators amongst American belief, but one thing I found in these sort of years of traveling around and talking to all sorts of different believers is the belief in free speech. The belief, not practice, the belief in free speech. And also the conviction.
Free speech for me, but not necessarily for you.
You know, the reason I get to talk to everybody is they say, well, I don't like what you're doing, Charlotte, but I believe in free speech. And they do practice it more often than you would think. But there's this interesting idea that a lot of religious folk, Christians and Jews and Muslims, think, well, that I have to believe in free speech because it's in my scripture. It's not. This is this kind of American contribution, and it spreads out in this book, I'm looking at anarchists and this sort of as a religious tradition, and even people who are sort of committed to music and a certain kind of rock and roll sort of spirituality in a religious tradition, all sort of drawn by this. I don't even want to use as soft a word as pluralism, a noisy word, cacophony, and that the understanding that there's going to be many, many voices and that they'll clash, and that sound of them clashing is really a great noise. It's the sort of, this is the noise of democracy, not harmony.
And they don't say, we'd like to get rid of all those other sounds because ours is the only one that is the true sound?
Well, there is that, too. Yeah, there is that, too. There's a story in the book called She Said Yes. It's about the most militant, fundamentalist youth movement in the country called Battle Cry. And to give you a sense of the militants, the leader, Ron Luce, told me that I am a terrorist, lest I misunderstand that. And he said, I don't mean that as a metaphor. He would say, you too, Leonard, are terrorists. All of us, in fact, in the secular media, are terrorists no different than Al-Qaeda.
He call himself an evangelical?
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Although I think it would be fairer to call him a fundamentalist. You know, there's sort of a distinction there. He's on the hard right edge of that movement. And even so, he let me travel along with him, attend his school, because he had this notion of free speech. He also had this notion of advertising. You know, there's always a sort of, everyone believes when you go and report on their belief system that you're going to be convinced. There's no coincidence that you came to my church, my compound, God or some other power led you here, and you're going to be converted.
But you also make the point here that he does rather well economically.
Yes, yes, he does. Yeah. What this movement does is they produce these concerts, these three-day concerts for kids around the country. And they can be 5, 10,000, 70,000 kids. And they're lots of fun. There's Christian rock bands, there's pyrotechnics, there's big light shows and so on. If you're 13, it's great. It's not really all that much different than an Alice Cooper concert. But then the ideology comes in, and as I describe in that story, and She Said Yes, sort of the culmination of the rally is Luce illustrating a biblical story in which a woman is killed and cut up into 12 pieces and sent out to the tribe of Israel. Ron Luce is like one of those guys who says the Bible is full of everyday, common sense applicable to your everyday life. And he includes that story and he brings out a mannequin. And as the 5 or the 10,000 or the 70,000 kids, chant, he gets them chanting, cut up the concubine, cut up the concubine. And he says, this represents secularism. And he tears it apart and sends it out into the crowd. And it's spectacle. and it's also fundraiser. You know, these kids get impassioned and political. And, you know.
And what does the concubine represent?
Secularism. In fact, the concubine is labeled with the different parts. In the original story, the idea is that the 12 pieces of the woman's body are sent out to the tribes of Israel as a warning of godlessness. And Luce sees that as applicable today.
Is his group also the one that's behind the Hell House, haunted houses?
Yeah, well, there's many people who produce Hell Houses, but the Hell House in my book comes at the end of that story, and it's in some ways, I think, illustrative of why I included this story in a book of people, many of whom I admire. I started out writing a story about this guy, Ron Luce, who you can tell I'm not too fond of. You know, he has his plus sides, I guess. He puts on a good show, but he's it's kind of a terrifying man, and the story becomes the situation where I go with a number of his followers to a hell house, a haunted house for conservative Christians, where the frights aren't vampires and so on. They are what they see as the terrors of secularism. There's one room where two actors pretending to be gay are kissing, you know, shudder. And there's women walking around disguised as Muslims, and that's your werewolf, I guess, you know. And the young people I went to this thing with, who are followers of this militant movement, as we progressed through it and as they sort of responded to these assertions about the world around them, started pushing back. You know, so they started without even realizing, in some ways, practicing their own free speech. And that's something I always find, is that there is no orthodoxy. There's always dissonance.
And there's interesting ways that things do get pushed back. You write about Clear Channel, which I would never think of as being a subject for a book like this. Where does that fit into the story?
Well, Clear Channel is, in fact, very similar to the She Said Yes story. It started out... it's sort of an inversion with the fundamentalist story. I start out with the portrait of the big bad guy and ended up working my way down to these sort of start out with Goliath and work my way down to David, the dissidents within the movement. Queer Channel, I started out writing about a David character, a young concert producer in Philadelphia who was taking on the system. And he is an admirable guy, but I got more and more interested in the Goliath side of it, the many faces of this massive media company. And these people who loved radio and loved rock and roll and loved music and, you know, because they couldn't get jobs at NYC, they had to, you know, go out and work for Clear Channel. And
is that the way it works? Clear Channel probably would be paying me 20 or 30 times what I make here.
Yes.
Maybe a lot more than that. There are all sorts of reasons people would choose to work for Clear Channel, but it's radio, and it's also they also produce concerts.
At the time, they were producing concerts, and it was so all-encompassing. And in Philadelphia, where I kind of concentrated part of the story, it was such that even if you went to like your little punk rock club, it's gritty, you know, like wires hanging from the ceiling and beer on the floor and you know, real just, this is not corporate. It's Clear Channel. And you asked why I saw it as in this collection of books about faith and faithlessness. It was the man who was producing that who was angry at me for pointing out that he worked for Clear Channel. And then sort of toward the end of our conversations, he says, but look, you know, there's still that moment when you're seeing a band and it could be Neil Young or Van Halen. It's like for the very first time. And he says, it's like you're bearing witness. And it's not cha-ching. It's something else. And he had this sort of spiritual sense about it.
So you're saying Clear Channel gives you good stuff, but they also...
Well, no, I'm not. I'll take a stand here. Clear Channel is Clear Channel bad.
They shut down a church that was having concerts without a permit.
Yeah, yeah.
That means they are pretty powerful, isn't it? They also, it's been pointed out...
It was alleged that they shut down the church, I should say.
They issued a do not playlist after 9/11. What songs did they not allow on their radio stations?
Well, this became sort of a kind of lefty folklore that they were preventing all these peace songs from being played after 9/11, like Peace Train and Imagine. And that's true. But then when you look at the list, they were also preventing, Rock the Casbah, because they thought it was pro-war, or they were preventing, you know, AC/DC songs from being played. And when I looked into it, the list, this as it became known as the list with capital letters, had not come down from corporate, but it had risen up from all these station managers around the country. The censorship was, and it was censorship, But it was sort of more disturbing. It wasn't cutting out left or right. It was cutting out almost sort of everything and creating this sort of homogenous hum. And that, to me, is the real true danger of them.
My guest is Jeff Charlotte, whose latest book is Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. It's published by Norton. You start out in Colorado with your former college girlfriend, Molly Knott Chilson. What is it about Colorado and Molly that made you want to go back and take a look at faith in the West?
I think Colorado, in particular, that Western mythology, is about as close to religion as I've ever personally come. And when I was a young guy...
Well, that's a belief in the uniqueness of the individual?
The whole mythos, the idea of the mountains as a place where you go and you find redemption, where you're reborn, where you become this new creature, you know, like Jeremiah Johnson or, you know, Mountain Man or something like this. And then the sort of the romanticism of you know, studying Native American history, which can sometimes blur the reality and, you know, the true suffering of Native Americans. And Molly was this person who I'd known and embodied that for me, because she was a real true Coloradan. We'd been lefties together in college. First date was picking her up from jail. And then over the years, she became a very conservative Republican, still brilliant. And I wanted to go and sort of see, and she felt that that was the embodiment of the same Western mythology. So the story becomes sort of a journey story of seeing how these two things diverge so radically.
So what has she become? Were you surprised by what she works at now?
She, in some ways, it was continuous. We met protesting the first Gulf War back in the early 90s, and the protests in our little college town were fierce. A man had burned himself to death in protest in the common, and there were riots, and it was very rough stuff. And her sense then... She wasn't a Christian then, but her sense was almost biblical. She was sort of driven by this very fierce sense of justice. And that same sense of justice and even vengeance informed her work later as a prosecutor. She became DA for this huge four-county district. There was something sort of Melvillian about it all. She was a person who introduced me to Moby Dick and said, "You want to understand the mountains, you read Moby Dick, you read this book about ocean, and you read about vengeance." And that was what it was for her.
Well, you write about the kind of violence that people encounter in this area. It's called Salida, Colorado. Teenagers going on killing sprees, for example. Is this something that is a bigger problem there than in other parts of the country?
I think some things like, for instance, meth. Meth is a very big problem there, although I live in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire and Vermont, those kinds of drugs are a problem there, too. I think it's, you know, I'm surely not the first person to note this. There's a sense of there's another mythology that rural life is somehow peaceful and moral, and rural life is suffused with violence and crime and desperation, like in all other parts. And, you know, I wanted to get into that in that story.
Did Molly talk to you about the role of the gun control? I mean, the gun culture in this violence? She once gave you a gun as a gift, didn't she?
On Valentine's Day. Yeah, that was a Valentine's Day. My first and only gun. Still have it, a 22 rifle, which is a very modest gun, although it was a very big deal to me. I mean, Molly, when she turned toward the right, she embraced this Western mythology completely. She campaigned on horseback. One of her key points was that she was fifth generation Colorado, and she even had a sort of fake shootout as a fundraiser with like a ghost town and figures that are good guys and bad guys pop up, you know, cutouts, and you go through and you have to make very quick choices about which ones to shoot. And there's that kind of Western righteousness, good or evil, make your call quickly, that informed that. So the gun culture was a very big part of it.
Also in the West, so we see a lot of New Age spirituality. You write about it. Can you tell us about Sandra Shay?
Sandra Shay, Bhakti Sandra Shay, a wonderful woman who is actually here in New York. And this is where I really, I wanted to understand the economics of New Age religion. And Sandra, who's a sincere and thoughtful person, has a practice sort of faith-healing real estate. And I think not too many people realize that a lot of high-end real estate brokers in New York have someone like Sandra in their Rolodex. Property's not moving. They call in Sandra to perform various rituals. It's her call. They don't tell her, you know, just clean it, spiritually cleanse it. So Sandra and I go to this one apartment and she diagnoses it as bad sex energy. So she sprinkles some water around it. She constructs a magic circle around it. And the Corcoran broker is just sort of sitting there saying, you know, I hope this helps.
Is this different than feng shui?
This is different than feng shui because it involves a number of gods. It involves the astral plane. It involves St. Paul, whom she can channel. You know, the culmination of that story is when Sandra comps me to attend a workshop that she's producing. It's an expensive workshop. And
you say all of this comes with a price tag.
It all comes with a price tag, as does most religion. And I think she made the point that, you know, if you belong to a church, you typically tithe. The Catholic Church is, of course, I believe, one of the biggest real estate holders in the world. I didn't find that as, you know, spending time with her, I didn't find that as cynical as I thought I would. She makes a living. It's a decent living. It's not an extravagant living. The metaphors she sells, and they are just that, are metaphors, are usually purchased by people who are wide-eyed and, as I witnessed, sometimes helped by them, even though I personally don't believe that Sandra can channel Jesus. But, you know, who am I to say?
On the other hand, does she help the Corcoran people sell the apartments?
Well, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not
going to
cry tears for Corcoran if it doesn't work out for them. My own feeling is that a magic circle probably will not help you sell an apartment.
One of the people you write about is somebody who my listeners will recognize, Cornel West, who believes in prophetic pragmatism. Can you explain what he means by that?
Cornel has this idea, and what drew me to writing this story about him, you know, he's so well documented, but I felt that, in fact, just that phrase, prophetic pragmatism, a lot of the coverage about him and the questions he gets in the media don't go to the core of this idea of prophecy and prophetic discourse as a language that he believes is available to us all. And remember, he says prophecy is not predicting the future. It's not magical thinking. It's the description of present-day concrete evils.
Coming out of biblical thinking?
For him, it comes out of biblical
thinking.
Because
it also comes out of his interest in the philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, doesn't it?
And in even more, John Dewey. And, you know, as you say, the tradition of American pragmatism, which he reminds us, and one of the things I found so fascinating, is pragmatism is improvisational. And so he equates that to jazz. He has this idea of blues and jazz as this metaphor that can explain American democracy, its aspirations and its failings. And the one thing that doesn't normally come out about him is that you have to have with that a deep sense of mortality. Not a lot of people know that Cornel has stage 4 cancer, that he's a man who's facing death, but has also been thinking about death his whole life.
But how does this differ from anyone developing some kind of philosophical approach to the world? I mean, you may tell me that your idea, you have certain beliefs, and I may think, hey, gee, that sounds good or that sounds silly to me. But that's different than being subscribing to Marxism or being an anarchist or being a born-again Christian or a fundamentalist Muslim or a Hasidic Jew. They require a different kind of commitment, don't they?
They do. They certainly do. And I try to sort of get at a variety of those levels of commitment in the book. To me, what's interesting, certainly I find some of them more persuasive. You know, Cornell and my old friend Molly Knott Chilson, a conservative Molly and very radical Cornell, are at the beginning of the book because, in fact, they both ultimately deal with a recognition of suffering and of despair. And then they say the next step, and Cornell articulates it. Cornell says the most essential human dignity is the ability to contradict what is. And this, to me, was interesting as I started traveling amongst anarchists and all sorts of different writers, that the first step of political imagination is to say no to things as they are. It's not an affirmation, it's a no, and then you can open up this space. And so that's really what I'm trying to get at in the book, is the people who are doing that.
So tell us about Brad Will, who was, according to ABC's Nightline in 2004, one of America's 50 leading anarchists. I didn't even know they kept records of that sort of thing.
Certainly anarchists don't. And that was, you know, being called a leading anarchist was, you know, an oxymoron that Brad got a lot of laughs out of. Brad Will,
he was killed in Mexico.
He was killed in Mexico in 2006. He had become a journalist, an anarchist journalist, and he'd gone down to Oaxaca, Mexico, where there was a great uprising led by teachers' unions there. And this is Occupy Wall Street times 100. and he was covering a conflict and with his video camera, and he is very literally a martyr, a witness. He died bearing witness, and he was shot while he was filming police, and they shot him.
The police shot him?
Yeah. If you slow it down slow enough, you can actually see the puff of smoke of the bullet leaving the gun, and then bang, Brad falls down. And I wanted to know who this guy was and to reconstruct the story. What did he think was worth dying for? What did he think was worth living for? How was he contradicting what is? How was he failing to take into account the risks? You know, what was the imagination that drove him?
And how did he become radicalized?
He's an interesting character. There's a kind of a cliche of American radicalism of you know, we see it in the coverage of the Occupy movement, that it's all just rich kids who, you know, are rebelling against mommy and daddy.
Or their parents were liberals.
Or their parents were no good liberals. Brad was a rich kid from Illinois. His parents are not liberal at all. I went and spent time with them, quite conservative. And he never rebelled against them. And I found that one of the most moving. He's, no matter where he was, his whole, you know, 16 years as an anarchist, he's very close with his parents. I mean, in 1999, the big Seattle protests, he had to get out of jail in time because it was his mother's birthday, and he had to get home. And he didn't tell her where he'd been because he didn't want her to worry. But in his death, his very conservative parents, I mean, his mother still wears an American flag ring, they've become radicalized because they're sort of looking at what he was saying about the drug war, about U.S. relationships with Mexico, and as they investigate it and try to bring justice for their son, and there has been no justice, and the U.S. government has been no help.
There are two administrations.
Yeah, there's never been any help for them. I don't want to say they've become radicalized, but they've gotten a glimpse of the world as their son saw it and started to understand it for the first time.
Where does your book's title come from?
Sweet Heaven When I Die is a line from a song by a 1920s banjo player named Doc Boggs. Country Blues was the name of the song. Sweet Heaven When I Die, and it's kind of a jokey song, and it's kind of a fatalistic song. Doc Boggs recorded 8 songs in the late 20s, and then he pawned his banjo. The record company thought they had a star, and he went back in the mines because he said, I wasn't going to work for them. No Clear Channel for him, you know? 30 years, and then he's resurrected in the 60s folk revival, and everyone thinks he's this sweet old man, and as he starts playing these songs, he gets drawn back to the 1920s, to the original darkness that led him to sing, and the original recognition of suffering, his, others. He's not a nice man. He's a nasty, nasty man, and I wanted the kind of the irony, but like tiny thread of hope that is in that song to give the book its title. The original title, I should say, was we can't say it on the air. It's from the name of the bar that gave its title to the Colorado essay, Sweet F All Colorado. It was a bar called that. And I think we wisely decided at the last minute. This is a better title.
9/11 comes up frequently in these essays. Was it an important moment for a lot of the people that you spoke to and for the religious movements that you write about?
Yeah, and I think, you know, my first book, which is sort of, this is maybe in some ways a companion to, is I wrote with novelist Peter Mansell, and we explored the varieties of religious experience around America. We made the deal with our publisher on September 10th, 2001, celebrated that night, and then, you know, with kind of a glib idea of what we're going to do to explore, and then as we set out in the country, everyone was taking belief, I don't want to say religion, belief much more seriously. That's dissipated, but even now, I think it still remains a touchstone to which people, when they try to explain things that are important to them, return again and again.
Do you think that so many people were open with you because they hope to convert you to their ideas?
Always, always. Wherever you go, you know, they think you're going to, I mean, you know, not Cornel West or the Yiddish novelist Hava Rosenfarb. She wasn't going to convert me. Well, I was already interested in Yiddish. I guess I was already sold. But yeah, there is always this sense. And that's the flip side of the belief in free speech, is the belief that your particular free speech is so awesome that once people hear it, they're going to come to believe. But there's this other interesting moment that I found in these years, like with Sandra Shea. You know, she's okay, if you're going to shadow me around for a while, we need to do some spiritual work on you. I had to go through these rituals. But by the end, you know, she realized I wasn't going to come around to her way of thinking. And she's channeling Jesus, and she says, it's okay. I know you don't believe in me. This is supposedly Jesus speaking. He says, that's okay, because doubt is a calling. Doubt is not unbelief. Doubt is something in between, and doubt is your revelation. And I think that's always this nice moment when you come to terms with someone you're writing about like that.
Jeff Charlotte, Sharlett, best-selling author of The Family and C Street, co-author of Killing the Buddha. He's a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and Harper's, and he teaches creative nonfiction at Dartmouth. His latest book, Sweet Heaven, When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between, it is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.